Lifestyle.
You'll forgive me if I don't stay around to watch. I just can't cope with the freaky stuff.
Don't worry, darling. It's the New Flesh Podcast. A podcast about horror movies and all things tangentially related to horror, horror movies, and the horror lifestyle, which absolutely includes this week's mainstream release, the much talked about Don't Worry, Darling, a film by Olivia Wilde, an Olivia Wilde joint. If Barbarian was White People Get Out, this is... also, what is it? White Women Get Out? Women yeah, Get Out, yeah. I guess. It definitely feels very Jordan Peele inspired. We'll get into that. It feels inspired by a lot of things that I did not expect it to be inspired by. One very loud one that I feel like is probably the inspiration directly. But we'll talk about all of this because this is the episode on Don't Worry, Darling. I'm going to say all the SEO terms that are important right now in case there's an audio SEO. Florence Pug. Chris Pine, Harry Styles, spit. There was a controversy involving spit. We won't get into it unless we do get into it. Rumors, behind the scenes drama. What other keywords am I missing here?
Stan culture?
Hashtag feminism. Hashtag Stan culture. I don't know what the Harry Styles people call themselves.
But wild styles?
The wild styles. The styles heads, the hairy heads, the hairy housens.
The hairy housens.
They're definitely a part of the narrative here in a way. But I don't know. I don't want to get into the weeds on all that stuff. We're here to talk about the movie, which absolutely qualifies to be talked about on a horror podcast, yeah. I reckon. We're also talking about all the horror news of the week that's fit to print. I had COVID this week for the first time, which feels like a miracle that I didn't get it up until this point. I definitely felt immune, was going around licking subway poles and stuff. I cannot be touched. And more suspicious, my COVID case was, it happened at the most convenient time possible. It's so suspicious. My wife is very suspicious of me. She does think I was going around licking subway poles because I got
trying to get it.
I got it on Monday, which, you know, I got it on Monday and we were supposed to fly to Las Vegas on Thursday morning for a wedding over the weekend. And I got sick with just enough time to miss the wedding.
Right.
Which, sorry to if they're listening. Love you guys, but I love my home and I don't like leaving or traveling, leaving the dog. There was a million stressors and reasons why I didn't want to leave my apartment. And that worked out. I feel like I got like a monkey paw curse and I curled it so I could stay home. And the reason I say it's suspiciously convenient is like I missed that. And then I also was still able to see Don't Worry, Darling today because it was out of the 5-day COVID window that I was supposed to stay in my house. And I did all that. And then I went and saw Don't Worry, Darling in a noon pretty empty screening that had open captions just to make sure it was even emptier than normal. but I was able to do that. And you're listening to your regularly scheduled New Flesh podcast. On Monday, one casualty of the COVID was Jesse and I did not record the New Fletch podcast, the the much talked about bonus episode that we were going to do last week that we will now do this week, talking about Confess Fletch, the new Fletch movie. Yes, that's Fletch, the Chevy Chase series, now starring John Hamm in the titular role. You and I have done more to promote this movie than the company that made it by mentioning it more than once on this podcast. But just to complete the joke of saying This is the New Fletch podcast. We're still going to do that episode. We're going to talk about Confess Fletch, the new Fletch movie, as well as Fletch and Fletch Lives, which Jesse and I have both now watched. And if you ever wondered why were there no Fletch movies for so long, check out Fletch Lives. You might get an answer.
It's a concise 90-minute answer to that question.
Absolutely. So what's going on, Jesse? This is a new Flesh After Dark recording, which they kind of all have been lately due to our crazy schedules. Jesse, we need a Harry Potter update. Where are you in the Harry Potter bedtime read?
I actually didn't finish the chapter. The Harry Potter, we're in Half-Blood Prince. We're in, like, you know, because it takes so goddamn long to them get to Hogwarts in each book, where they just got to fucking Hogwarts 150 pages in.
Going to Hogwarts, Mr. Potter.
I just had a big Snape scene, so I was doing a lot of bad Alan Rickman impression.
What did people do before the movies when they were reading Snape?
I know. I was thinking about that because, yeah, I just can't help but do the two actors who I can't help but imitate while doing it are Alan Rickman and Brendan Gleeson, soon to be SNL host Brendan Gleeson, because he plays
He has to be entering the Five Timers Club at this point. You mean Brendan Gleeson hasn't hosted SNL regularly?
I'm so excited for him. But yeah,
I'm delighted. But that was like, nobody in any SNL, like the SNL experts, the people who have podcasts, the people who pontificate about this stuff all day on Twitter.
Not a single soul
was like, yeah, we got Brendan Gleeson for Banshees of Inisherin. nobody had that.
There was some season where Woody Harrelson hosted the premiere, and this is like a similar, I mean, well, Harrelson had done it before, but like the season premiere, everyone was like, buh, like what the fuck?
Yeah, I mean, like Woody Harrelson's like somebody,
but he's a household name.
Like, he was
name.
Like a TV star. He was a name. Yeah. Like, I mean, this sounds mean to Brendan Gleeson. He's a name to me, but like,
yeah,
I don't think my parents know who that is by name.
Well, did you read them Harry Potter? Because he's Mad-Eye Moody in Harry Potter.
Yeah, if I did my Mad-Eye, they'd be like, oh, that guy for sure.
You're late again, Potter.
That was pretty good.
Well, those, because those are the two I really relish doing. Rickman isn't very good, but like, you're absolutely right. Like, how on earth did someone just think of a voice for Snape? I mean, I should listen to the audiobooks because that guy is supposed to be great, and he must have done those before Alan Rickman was cast. Maybe Alan Rickman was doing what he did, but like, probably not. It's probably because it's so Alan Rickman-y. And it's hard not, because there's no other way to read Snape but just poorly imitate Alan Rickman. And for the first book and a half.
Friends.
Yeah, that's good. It took me a long time to get it. Like, it was really.
I don't think I have it. I'm grasping. I'm trying.
I mean, I think you were better than I was for the first book and a half. Well,
Pete Holmes used to do a bit about doing Alan Rickman and how it's like you have to like give yourself like you're drinking milk and you have like milk in the back of your throat when you're talking.
Because I was sort of doing it in a way that just made him sound like. I don't know. It sounded a little more like Dracula. That's not even like Dracula.
Yeah, but you can get that you're trying to do Rickman, but it doesn't sound like.
Yeah, but it doesn't sound. But then you do have to. You have to kind of hold something in the back of your throat, like
in
you're going
to. In the back of your throat.
It.
Yeah. You have to do too much, like you're doing, like an alien or like a conehead. I don't know what I'm doing anymore. Coneheads talked weird, right? Yeah. They had a whole movie where they talked weird. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw her in the movie theaters. I can't wait to talk about its 30th anniversary next summer. Consume mass quantities.
Just crickets when you did that pitch everywhere all over town. Yeah. It's the 30th anniversary of Coneheads, everyone. Yeah. Everyone's holding their little like foam fingers for 30 years of Coneheads.
Yeah. Consume mass quantities, baby. Yeah. I don't know. Harry Potter's going fine. I'm looking forward to
Half-Blood Prince. You're a Half-Blood Prince Potter.
See, it's not bad. You should come over. Next chapter is you. We'll have you do it.
I told Jessie if she wasn't in bed by the time we started recording, just throw me on. I'll read a chapter. I'll pull up a PDF. Books are free now, right? I can just pull that up online.
Yeah,
probably.
Just Can I tell you the thing that I do sparingly by necessity that my wife and child both loathe about when I'm reading Harry Potter, also based on the movies? Because I mostly try to just like kind of do generic British accents or generic Irish accents.
Do you do the theme song like in between chapters?
Oh,
like,
I should. Now, I don't know if you remember the character Cho Chang, who is a sensitively named per J.K. Rowling's beautiful, not at all heavy-handed touch.
I need an Asian character. What shall I call her? Let me consult my banking goblin to see what he thinks.
But exactly. So that's a character that Harry has a crush on for a couple of the books. And in the movies, it just happens that the actress they hire is of Asian descent, but she's also Scottish, or at least does a Scottish accent. And has this lovely, cute little, like, you know, kid Scottish accent. So that is my cue, of course, to perform Cho Chang as if she is Fat Bastard from Austin Powers. And she's always like, "Harry, it's Cho Chang here." And it's my...
I married an ex-murderer broad level comedy.
Yes. Without any jokes, just her bellowing up Cho Chang. And my daughter's always like, "Stop." Like, I don't like this like, at all.
I didn't watch the Pentaveret and I don't need this bullshit.
my wife's hearing me in the other room when I'm doing this, like cringing and being like, "Just shut it down." Because she's like, you're fine at Seamus, the Irish guy. But the Scottish thing is too much and you have to stop. But I just can't. I just love it. I love doing it too much. And I'm sad that Cho Chang is marginalized in the remainder of the books that we're doing. So I can't have any more bellowing Scotsman dialogue for
her. You should take some liberties with the story and just start going off on Cho Chang side
flips. I did improv some dialogue for Cho Chang on the side. I was getting a look, and then I was like, all right, I'm going back to the real story.
Having kids sounds awesome. I want to do that. I want to read them Harry Potter, but subtly inject my own philosophy and perspective into the text.
No, you have to balance it out, right?
And they'll go to school and be like, "Yeah, my favorite scene is when Harry decapitates Ron." And everyone will be like, "What the fuck are you talking about?"
You have to balance out her being a weirdo, an anti-trans weirdo in real life, and you have to improv some pro-trans, more
the trans character
stuff.
Walks by and all characters approved of her lifestyle.
Exactly. You just have to balance. It's fine to consume the books. You just have to add a little of your own spin on it. That's a little more humanist perhaps than old mean old Joe Rowley.
Well, you know what they say about humanism, Jesse? It is one true special effect. And on that note, we got to get to the news of the week. There's so much of it. I would say the biggest news of the week in the horror world is that Barbarian, I believe it was a couple days ago at this point, it had crossed the $23 million mark, which is a nice milestone for a movie that cost $4 million and opened to $10 million and is now in its third weekend, doing fairly well, having very small drops week to week. One of the reasons it had a very small drop this week, which I think was like 28%, Jesse, I don't know if you looked. Mm-hmm. It was like a 28% drop this week. That's because Barbarian expanded into more theaters in its third week of release. It added 550 new screens in its third weekend. So now it's playing in just under 3,000, like 2,890 screens in the US. So that is a very rare, something you don't see anymore story of, like, that is truly just positive word of mouth making a movie. Like they're coasting on it, you know what I mean? It's rare to see them realize that instead of being like, "Oh, it's doing well, let's shunt it on VOD while people are still talking about it and make them watch it." Instead, they're saying, "No, we're making this a theatrical only experience that people are talking about and they're going to see it still, so let's milk it." And not only that, they cut a new trailer that I would say is a spoiler trailer, in that it reveals something that happens in the middle of the movie as if it's the beginning of the movie, kind of. I don't know if you watched that. It's
I have not. Oh boy, that doesn't sound.
Spoiler alert!
It's been out for a few weeks. But
yeah,
still.
I guess I'm gonna just say spoiler alert right here. If you don't know anything about Barbarian, skip ahead 30 seconds right now. The new trailer, Jesse. It's on the 20th Century Studios page, and it's titled on YouTube, "Justin Long's New Movie." And it has him, it has the scene, it has his introduction scene. And it says, like, It says something about, it might say from the producers of Alvin and the Chipmunks. It definitely has from the producers of the Lego Movie and Alvin and the Chipmunks is what this one. Okay. And the studio that brought you Alvin and the Chipmunks. And like it highlights all the other elements that it's like the opposite trailer of the first one where it's highlighting the heel turn rather than the what comes before it. So very funny to see that, especially if you've seen it. I'm kind of annoyed that I'm interested to see what people think who just see that trailer and then go see the movie now. Like an interesting focus group experience I would like to have. But it's still out there, man. Week 3, if you haven't seen Barbarian, I'm assuming they have no plans to put it on VOD immediately. I'm predicting that actually will like probably surprise everyone and just put it out right before Halloween or something. But they're definitely milking it in theaters, and you should benefit from that by going to see it if you haven't. This movie, do I have the numbers here? I think the numbers today came in. Barbarian made another, 4.8, down 26% only, actually. So it's at 28% domestic, and I think it has some international already. It's at another million. So it will be at 30 worldwide in like a day. Incredible. Incredible run for Barbarian. And everyone who listens to the show knows that we can attribute that box office great hold to the hashtag New Flesh Bump.
That's right. The New Flesh Bump. That's also the New Flesh Bump didn't do is because we were not as united on Pearl. They only had a bump of, they were had the 38% drop, which is great for that kind of movie.
Yeah, you're right. I was going to say Pearl died on the vine, but it didn't. It had a 39% drop. It just isn't making as much as Barbarian. It made like just under 2 million this weekend for a total of 6, and that means what did it make last weekend? Like 4?
Yeah, I mean, I think like 3 and change. It made a little less than X, and it's on that trajectory.
Pretty sure Pearl costs like $1 million, though. I think X also is like pegged as $1 million. So all these movies
these are movies people will buy on to the extent that people buy the stuff on physical media, or like I guess people buy downloads.
I already bought X.
They'll buy them. Yeah,
I bought X on Blu-ray actually, and then I watched it right before Pearl. And got hyper pissed off about how some movies don't get 4K physical releases. So X is one of those movies. Like Lionsgate, I guess, is the company that like distributes A24 movies at home. They put it out on Blu-ray. And the most annoying thing about when a movie is like a new movie comes out on home video and there's a Blu-ray but no 4K, the fucked up part is you can get the 4K on digital for most of the time. Not always. But in the case of X, you can. So if you were to buy X on iTunes and watch it presented, so however you get your shit to your TV or your projector, if you were to watch it via the download on iTunes or the stream on iTunes, whatever you do when you buy it, it would look way better than the fucking Blu-ray I bought, which pisses me off. That's really annoying. That's annoying. And I know there's a lot of people. I have a couple. Matt on Letterboxd is always telling me the virtues of using my digital library, which, God, I feel like I can't even start one just because of how many I've spurned over the years, right? I've had hundreds, if not thousands, of digital copies I've just let waste, and it's really frustrating. So I feel like I can't start one out of spite, but I kind of just did because Matt on Letterboxd clued me into like iTunes has sales every now and then. So I got Crimes of the Future on 4K. For $8, and the disc doesn't exist, and there's only a Blu-ray, and I think there actually will be a 4K that one. Anyway,
do they let you download it, the actual file, so it's not something where they
I don't think so. Like, I think you can download it to the extent that, like, if you're going on a plane, there's an option to like download it to your phone, and like you can download it to your desktop, I'm sure, for that same reason. But you definitely don't own it, and if Apple one day their licensing agreement ends with whoever with Lionsgate, then I don't own that anymore. And like, I know that, but like, I know people when they buy it, they don't think about that, but there's definitely documented cases of people's shit disappearing that they paid for and bought. So I hate the idea. And I think that if you're going to release content, new content, if you're going to put something out on Blu-ray, you may as well put it out on 4K. I know there's like bottom lines that they can say what it makes sense for them to do. I'm sure there's reasons they don't do it, but it pisses me off as a consumer. X shouldn't look that bad on my TV, which is like, you know, formatted for nice 4Ks. So a Blu-ray that's not 4K stands out. And I know that's like privilege problems here, but I'm paying for all the shit. I bought the thing on day one. It pisses me off that it doesn't look, you know, like pop, reference quality. Yeah, it should be perfect. Anyway, rant over. If you want digital copies of movies, I'm selling them on eBay, but eBay doesn't let you sell digital copies. So I'm constantly on the verge of being banned from eBay. So if you want digital copies of anything, hit me up on Twitter. I will sell you them for really cheap. I have hundreds. Some good shit. And all of it in 4K, which is, you know, the whole point of what we're talking about. Okay. Rant over. Congratulations, Barbarian. And also congratulations to Pearl. Go see those movies. Anyway, biggest news of the week. We know who's directing Final Destination 6, which I don't know if it's actually being called Final Destination 6 or if it's going to be called Final Destination because it's going to be a remake or something. Anyway, John Watts of Spider-Man fame and Clown and Cop Car is on board as producer. We knew this. We knew that Laurie Evans Taylor, who wrote Wicked Wicked Games, and Guy Busick, who wrote Scream 2021 and is a friend of the New Flesh podcast, we knew that he was writing. The newest update is that Zach Lipofsky and Adam B. Stein are on board to direct the movie. But the most interesting story here is how they got it. They have a story that is called the story in the Hollywood Reporter talks about how it was like an insane process to try to find directors, and it took a good portion of the year. It took up a good portion of the year to find the director. Over 200 candidates were submitted, and it was rare that something this big was available and ready for a reboot. So of course everyone wanted it, and these two guys rose to the top thanks to their ideas and passion for the Final Destination brand. And they had a Zoom pitch meeting that went like this. They made their pitch to the New Line executives and producers together with a burning fireplace behind them. And as they wrapped up the meeting, the fire came alive and the mantle began burning. And the filmmaker stopped and, after a tense moment, quickly extinguished the flames. And then they sat back down. Everyone was relieved that this accident had just passed. And then a wrenching creak was heard, and suddenly the ceiling fan broke off and flew down, decapitating one of the filmmakers on the Zoom call. So the executives isn't that insane?
Amazing.
The executives and producers went from concern to all out laughter, obviously realizing it was a bit. And the bit was done using a combination of pre-recorded footage and visual effects, and it transitioned seamlessly. And it, you know, showed that they had like technical know-how as well as enthusiasm for the project. So that was like a cherry on top moment, it says. It wasn't like, this is why we did it, but it was like, we were going to hire these guys anyway, but that's a great reason to do it. So they got the job. They directed a movie I've never seen that you may have and a lot of people thought was decent. A genre movie, I believe, called Freaks from 2018.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that. Heard the title, but yeah.
It was one of those movies that sold at a festival in 2018, I think at TIFF, and then was like in the Netflix top 10 at some point, but like one of those movies that never really had a release or any heralded, I feel like you never heard about it. And it stars Emile Hirsch and Bruce Dern, and they're also Emmy nominated TV directors whose recent work includes Fraggle Rock for Apple, which I didn't know was a thing, but apparently that's a thing. The duo have a slate of projects around town, including a rock climbing thriller called Dead Point at Spyglass Entertainment, but their next project will be directing Final Destination 6. And we love this franchise. We've covered it on the show. I'm excited. I couldn't be more excited. It's one of those franchises that really shouldn't have ever stopped. I feel like these movies, I could watch one every year, like a Saw movie, you know?
Yeah, I'm surprised that there's certainly been bigger gaps in certain horror series where I'm surprised by them. But Final Destination, it is surprising that
it's been 11 years.
Yeah, that's amazing. Especially because there was kind of a gap between 4 and 5, and 5 did pretty well, if I recall correctly.
It definitely did, and there was. I don't remember the gap, but it was a couple years, if not more. And it's been, I think it was 2011 that Final Destination came out, which I believe was supposed to be like, the Final Destination? I don't remember what they were. It was like a big, like, it's going to be the last one, or maybe that was the one before the last one. I don't know. I can't keep up. Go listen to the New Flesh podcast episodes on Final Destination. We had Reddick, the creator, on the show, Jeffrey Reddick. Cool. And it was so much fun to talk about the original movie and the pitch and where, you know, how it all came to be. Reddick teased this one's a true Final Destination movie, but doesn't follow the formula that we've established. Huh? What does that mean? So, will Death not be hunting down young friends who survive a mass casualty event? We'll have to find out. Whenever that happens, there's no release date and there's no plot. So, it's happening though. And know what else is happening? Babak Anvari, director of Under the Shadow and the criminally underrated Wounds, he just did something called I Came By that's on Netflix that I still haven't watched because I haven't heard anything crazy about it, but I do want to watch it. I don't think it's genre-y enough for me to drop everything and watch it, but let me know if Babak Anvari's I Came By on Netflix is good. But his next project is a new Cloverfield movie, Jesse.
Yes.
Yes, there's a new Cloverfield movie. We haven't had one since the one that surprise dropped after the Super Bowl on Netflix because it was terrible and Paramount did not want to put it out in theaters, so they buried it on Netflix. Buried it by giving it a splashy Super Bowl release and making everybody watch it when it surprise dropped. And we all did, and nobody liked it. But anyway, they didn't tarnish the brand, apparently, Jesse, because we're both excited for the prospect of a new Cloverfield movie.
For sure.
And the last time this project popped up, it had been described as a true sequel to Cloverfield. But Deadline reported that all plot details are under wraps, and it is unknown how it will link to its predecessors, whether it's a straight sequel to the original or an anthology piece that is set in the Cloverfield universe. Which, spoiler alert, if I recall correctly, 10 Cloverfield Lane was like, it's this fun, cool kidnapping movie with this chick stuck in a guy's basement. And then the reason she's in the basement is because he's paranoid about the monsters that are out there and they're actually yes. real.
Yeah. Yes.
That's kind of, that was fun. That was a fun time.
Yeah. That was I like that movie. Yeah. Yeah.
It was a good movie. Shout out to was Dan Trachtenberg, director of Prey, for that mm-hmm. one. Either way, it sounds like this one is a Cloverfield movie from the ground up. We're not going to be surprised by it. I personally would be delighted if it was a sequel to the original in that it's just like that creature doing more shit. I don't know.
Doing stuff. Yeah.
Was the implication in, I don't remember, was the implication in 10 Cloverfield Lane that there's a bunch of these, or was it like the same guy?
I don't remember. Like, there was, it's so vague. Like, in Cloverfield Lane, I think it feels
he just
like
shows up like, in the background, right? Or like stomps through the area or something.
Or like it's like maybe multiple, you know, like a second monster or more monsters have attacked. I think it's kind of like my recollection is that sort of like down the lane from Cloverfield, there's been maybe more, or he, I don't know, maybe it's just the same one stomping around.
Yeah, because I think the Cloverfield paradox, the whole thing was like we opened a space time continuum and a bunch of monsters got out. So yeah. It would make sense that there it'd be more than just my little guy with like the Princess Leia thing on his head. You know, he has a weird look. He has like these little bulbs on his head. Yeah. I love that guy. I love Cloverfield so much. It's a movie I've bought several times. I think I bought it on DVD, Blu-ray, and now I bought the 4K, which is such a stupid movie to buy on 4K because it's handheld and found footage-y. But maybe that's why it looks the best. But I haven't rewatched it in years. And I definitely will use this announcement opportunity to do so. Get my TJ Miller on. The Nun 2, it's coming September 8th, 2023, and we have a star. Storm Reid of Euphoria and definitely some other horror movies we've covered. I forget which ones, but she's definitely in some stuff we've covered on the show. She's the star of it. That's news. It's not Tysa Farmiga, who was Sister Irene in The Nun, which was set in 1952 Romania, but it came out in 2018, I believe. So this movie is set in 1956, 4 years after the last one, in France. A priest is murdered, an evil is spreading. The sequel to the worldwide smash hit, The Nun, follows Sister Irene as she once again comes face to face with the demon force Valak, the demon nun. So it does reference Tysa Farmiga's character in the description. So maybe she's in it, or maybe they haven't updated it. Who knows? Kella Cooper, who co-wrote Malignant, will be writing it. So that makes me excited.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm excited for another Conjuring Universe movie. It's been a while. The last one was The Conjuring The Devil Made Me Do It, which was pretty disappointing. Yeah. What else is going on in the Conjuring Universe? I feel like there's nothing going on anymore besides The Nun 2.
There's not another Annabelle in the works, I don't think.
Not at the moment, not that I'm aware of. I don't think there's another Annabelle, but there definitely will be, especially when The Nun 2 hits and people go see it in droves. The Nun made $365 million in 2018 and presumably cost like, I don't know, 20?
Eight?
Eight. Yeah. Truly, it didn't cost very much. Very profitable movie. All these horror movies are for them. Horror movies are profitable always. Something that has become... We talk about this every few months on this podcast for the past 8 years. We're always being like, yeah, the box office, pretty consistent horror. Who knew? Anyway, David Cronenberg's Scanners is coming back to life as a TV show for HBO. And he is, I believe, producing or executive producing. Yeah, executive producing, a.k.a. I give my approval and we'll take your money.
Yeah.
Scanners... of course, told of a small group of superpowered people with a range of psychic, telepathic, and telekinetic power. One faction of Scanners, I don't need to talk about the plot of Scanners, but the show is being described as a visceral thriller set in the mind-bending world of Cronenberg's film. It will focus on two women living on the fringes of modern society who are pursued by relentless agents with unimaginable powers and thus must learn to work together to topple a vast conspiracy determined to bring them to heel. There's already like spinoffs of our Scanners. There's a sequel called The New Order and The Takeover and spinoff movies like Scanner Cop and Scanner Cop 2. Scanners was never my favorite Cronenberg movie, but it is great. And I'm excited for this. And I'm excited for Cronenberg for securing the bag, getting paid. He also has, I think there's like there's a Dead Ringers show at Amazon. So all these like culty David Cronenberg movies that are among my favorites are getting TV shows. Like, yeah, I'll begrudgingly watch it and hope it's good and probably stop watching it when it's not good, like I always do with things like this. But there it is. Scanners series is a co-production between HBO, Media Res, and Wayward Films. And as I mentioned, Cronenberg's executive producing. Speaking of Cronenberg, his son, Brandon Cronenberg, who did Possessor, which I've really come to love, and Antivirals, his first movie, which was just okay. He has a new movie that stars Mia Goth, and it's called Infinity Pool, and it was just rated NC-17 for some graphic violence and sexual content. And it's clear that, like, Neon wanted this information out there because there's stories about it, and it says, like, we hear Neon is intending to appeal this decision. So, like, they might end up getting an R, but, like, they wanted the press that said, oh, this movie's hardcore. It's getting an NC-17. Yeah. So it stars Mia Goth. It stars Alex Skarsgård. I believe Possessor was also NC-17, or it may have just been unrated. It
probably went out unrated, yeah.
Yeah, but there's an unrated cut that, like, I believe if you watch it on Hulu, it even says, like, this is the unrated cut. And I got the 4K because it promised that it had the unrated cut. Anyway, NC-17, graphic violence and sexual content. The press release explains Alexander Skarsgård will star alongside Mia Goth, and he'll also serve as executive producer. James and M are young, rich, in love, and on vacation. Their all-inclusive resort boasts island tours and gleaming beaches, but outside of the hotel gates waits something much more dangerous and seductive beyond the edge of paradise. Can't wait for more Mia Goth. Can't wait for more Brandon Cronenberg. And maybe I can't wait for more Helena Rajan, the director of Bodies, Bodies, Bodies. Did you know, Jesse, that she had a movie from 2019? Let me know if you saw it. She had a movie from 2019 that was only at festivals and never got acquired. It was called Instinct. A24 just bought it and, like, put it out on, it was last Thursday. They had one of those, like, one night only, you can watch our movie online in our A24 screening room. They did a screening of Bodies, Bodies, Bodies with Instinct as a double feature. And I'm really pissed that there's no, like, they didn't actually release it yet. Like, there's no iTunes. Like, I can't go buy this movie. So hopefully there's a plan for them to release Instinct, because I'm very curious. It says the movie follows a criminal psychologist who becomes infatuated with a charismatic, manipulative patient. And I heard it was really good. Have you heard anything about this movie?
I have not. I think I remember hearing the title when it was circulating around festivals, but of course it was before I knew who the director was, so I did not pay that much attention. I was just like, is that the one with Anthony Hopkins and Cuba Gooding Jr.? And of course, It is not
it
that.
It wasn't, no.
Not a remake or anything. So I don't, yeah, I haven't even seen that Instinct, so I have no idea. That's, I too would be interested in checking it out, especially because the, you know, the kind of comic tone of Bodies, 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 which I really enjoyed, is so specific that I'd be interested to see what her, something she directed without that, presumably without that comic tone or in a different register, or whatever. It sounds good. I'd be interested. I hope they put it out, actually. Do you think it'll be like, are they prepping the Bodies, Bodies, Bodies criterion? And that's going to be like one of the, when they put one of those kind of B-side movies on the disc. Is that what they're going to do?
Your lips to God's ears, my friend. Make it happen. Bodies, 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 Instinct, Criterion, double. Like when I get Steven Soderbergh's, what, King of the Hill?
There's one King of the Hill has the underneath. I love it. It's so cool. Lena
the
Dunham's
underneath
Tiny
was
Furniture.
Terrific. I was so surprised because it's like a bonus feature. No, it's a full movie and it rocks.
Yeah. I still haven't watched Lena Dunham's like basically student film, but like a feature film. Like she, it's on Tiny Furniture. They also have like the first movie she made when she was like either in college or just out of college. And that sounded, you know, I think it was at some festivals. So I should check that out too. It's one of my favorite Criterion moves is when they just slip a second feature film on there.
We call that the Criterion B-side, and we love it. Fathom Events is bringing Universal Monsters back to theaters. This is not an ad for that. This is a warning against that. Just be warned, everybody. There's going to be all these cool sounding events at your local theater in October, and this is your friendly warning that they will not be presented in a way that looks good. So you're better off watching them at home, but I'll rail them off anyway. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead. Go ahead. Then I'll add my asterisk.
1932's The Mummy and Bride of Frankenstein 35 double feature on October 1st, October 9th and 10th. This bums me out that it's Fathom because I would totally go. Scream 2 25th anniversary. Would totally go to that. October 23rd and 27th. Bram Stoker's Dracula from 92.
Ooh,
yeah, I know.
That'd be nice.
Don't go.
Yeah, so they just played at the Paris, I think. Actually,
oh, that's true. That's right. On 35mm, much more sumptuous than this, like straight from satellite TV. October 25th, National Theater Live doing Frankenstein.
Oh, I saw that when they did that for the 10 years ago.
Is that Danny Boyle's Frankenstein or whatever?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And like that's one where the Fathom factor is not a big, is like it's already like a TV broadcast.
Yes, and that is okay. I would say that's okay because how else are you going to watch that?
Right, right.
And then October 29th, Creature from the Black Lagoon, Phantom of the Opera double feature. Tickets are on sale at fathomevents.com where you shouldn't go.
I will say, I actually went to a Fathom event this very afternoon.
Did you see Clerks 3?
No. No. I took my kid to see, my family and I went to go see Howl's Moving Castle because my daughter and my wife just read the book.
Your daughter was like, Daddy, I would like to see this movie. And you're like, I'm sorry, daughter. It's not presented in the proper format for the podcast host.
I'm not sure if the resolution will be high enough. Well, no, yeah, I was curious too, like, because I was kind of bracing myself for grumbling to myself about how we're just watching it on a giant TV. I don't know if it's just because the G Kids company does a good job, because they have there's a bunch of Fathom events that are doing Studio Ghibli movies, and G Kids is their distributor. I don't know if they just make sure.
Maybe they send the DCP, so it looked like a movie.
Because it looked great. Looked really like, and that's a really beautiful movie that I had not seen before, and it has beautiful animation. So I was like kind of looking for like, is this going to look smeary? Is this going to look like choppy, like a TV projected way too big? And it looked great. But that's the thing, we've talked about this before, it's not even that every single one is bad, it's that like three quarters of them are bad, and you never know when you're gonna get the one quarter that are fine.
Some transparency would be nice, like just say DCP or sorry, this is the crappy real, this is our crappy standard format, or this is gonna be presented in a way that is worth leaving my house for. Anyway, take your kids to stuff. It's fine. I feel like an asshole now.
No, I don't. Because you know what? I saw the trailer for the Frankenstein thing, and it looked like shit. I get why I wouldn't go to that either, even though I was excited, even though I would love to see that movie on the big screen.
Speaking of big screen, the big news in like upcoming horror this week is that the trailer for M. Night Shyamalan's Knock at the Cabin is out there. Of course, your boy did not watch it and refuses to watch it and will now be on notice until February 3rd, 2023, trying to avoid seeing a piece of this movie at all or reading the synopsis that's in front of me. But I do know that the movie is based on the bestseller by Paul Tremblay called The Cabin at the End of the World. And I know that that writer is subtly, not so subtly, upset at the marketing for the movie, not at all calling out that it's based on the book or highlighting that in any way, putting his name on it in any fashion. He's been retweeting every tweet mentioning it if you want to see how he really feels about it. But the new M. Night movie is coming out February 3rd. That's all I need to know. My butt's in a seat. But if you want to know more, check out the trailer for The Cabin at the End. Oh, no, wait, not Cabin at the End of the World. The movie's called Knock at the Cabin. The book is called The Cabin at the End of the World. But M. Night Shyamalan's Knock at the Cabin, Dave Bautista, Rupert Grint. What's your
Grint?
Do your Rupert Grint.
I when I redo Ron, I just redo generic British accent because Rupert Grint in those movies would just be like, you know, it's just always like blubbering and doing Chris Columbus directed mugging. Sorry, I'm like running down Rupert Grint. Whatever. I'm excited to see him in a grown up movie. I feel bad that I just said
Rupert Grint. The best thing, the only good thing about M. Night Shyamalan's Apple TV show that I'm putting in quotes TV show because it feels like the most made up thing as they go along I've ever seen. But Rupert Grint has fun on that show. Okay. Anyway, someone from Old is also in it. Nikki Amuka-Bird alongside Ben Aldridge and Jonathan Groff. But it's really a Dave Bautista joint. And we're looking forward to that for sure.
For sure.
There's a new Lionsgate horror movie out this Halloween. I was looking at the calendar, like what's coming out in October besides we got Smile next week. I think we've got a week off before then. We have Halloween Ends, of course, but like there's nothing coming out on actual Halloween, is there? Wrong. There is. Lionsgate is sneaking out a horror movie that you probably haven't heard of yet. It's called Pray for the Devil, and it's not Pray spelled the way you think it is, Jesse. It is P-R-E-Y for the devil.
Whoa. Yeah.
Whoa. The title was formerly, what if it was formerly Pray for the Devil the other way? No, it was formerly The Devil's Light, if you've heard of that movie for whatever reason. And it is described as such. In response to a global rise in demonic possessions, the Catholic Church reopens exorcism schools to train priests in the rite of exorcism. On this spiritual battlefield, an unlikely warrior rises, a young nun, Sister Anne. All right, we got a movie starring Sister Anne. It's directed by, God, this guy has a very one-note director. It's directed by The Last Exorcism's Daniel Stamm.
Oh, that movie, I remember the performance, the main performance by the main guy in that movie was really good.
I don't dislike that movie.
Yeah.
I don't remember it as much as you do, but
yeah,
I remember
that's,
liking
what
it.
That's most of what I remember. It's also that it's found footage and it kind of fails to find a good ending the way a lot of those things do. But I remember him being really good. We saw the trailer for this in front of the Invitation, or maybe you averted your eyes, but there was the trailer was playing in front of the Invitation, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I definitely didn't look at that. it's written by the guy who wrote Halloween H2O, which is like, I'm looking at that guy's IMDb. It's hilarious. He wrote a bunch of TV, including an episode. His first credit is an episode of Home Improvement. Then he directed something called Thunder Alley, several episodes of, or wrote episodes of. And then he did a bunch of other stuff, a couple more TV shows. Then he did Halloween H2O, which was like, I'm assuming, a massive success, right? Like,
It was a big hit in this
day. Yeah, it was a big hit. And then he went back to TV directing like knockoffs of Kung Fu Panda, like something called Chop Kick Panda.
Oh, boy.
He wrote that. He wrote Puss in Boots, A Furry Tale. Just Tappy Toes, A Fake Happy Feet. And then a couple Tom and Jerry things. And like that's been his career. And now he wrote this horror movie called Pray for the Devil. So that's fun. That's Robert Zappia. Maybe I should have him on the show because those are the most interesting people in Hollywood to me. The ones who do like Halloween H2O and then do Chop Kick Panda. That's so interesting. Virginia Madsen stars in this movie, or not? Does not star. She's not Sister Anne, but she's in the movie. It looks, there's a trailer. I haven't watched it. You saw it. How'd it look, Jesse?
it, you know,
memorable. It like one of, do you remember the trailer? Yeah. I'm just kidding.
It looked, I mean, it looked like one of those, it looked we like get, one of those exorcism movies from like, I don't know, I don't even know when this was, like 12 years ago when those
things
were really hot.
I was going to say, it seems, yeah, like, I still feel like we still get one every few years. Like,
yeah, yeah, that's true.
When was, well, I must have, I'm showing my age. I just, time passes and I don't recognize it. The Right feels like it's recent to me, but that is like a movie from 2011. The one with Anthony Hopkins.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
There's definitely exorcism movies at least once a year. Maybe I'm wrong. I feel like there had to be one last year. There's always one you haven't heard of. There was one a few years ago that was like, yeah, the Crank guy did this. Remember that one? There was like, oh, it was a found footage one. That was probably, again, like 4 years ago or something. So maybe there hasn't been one in a few years. Get at me if there's exorcism movies I'm missing. But maybe we're back. We're back in the exorcism loop. Constantine 2, right? That shows us what we're up against here. I wanted to shout out for fans of the show. I don't watch it, but it seems horror adjacent. The Witcher's coming back. Witcher Blood Origin, the spinoff, is December 2022. The Witcher Season 3, summer 2023. And I just because I thought it was funny to talk about The Witcher and then to also talk about Netflix, The Watcher, which is a Ryan Murphy limited series, but it looks totally hashtag horror lifestyle. It stars Naomi Watts and Bobby Cannavale. And it's based on a true news, rip from the headlines, true crime story of a family forced to move out of their house in the wake of increasingly disturbing behavior towards them. Like someone was like stalking them and calling them and fucking with them in their house. It sounds cool. Henry Juice and Ariel Schulman were going to direct it. So they produced this limited series of it. And then apparently they might direct a movie of it. Or said they were originally going to direct it, so I guess that's not happening. But the series premieres October 13th, and there's a trailer for that. Apparently Netflix had like their own D23, or like their own like...
Yeah, oh yeah.
We're going to announce a bunch of stuff. So that was the only one of interest to me at that whole event. Let the Right One In. Been talked about for years that it's being adapted into a TV show. It's finally happening, and it's finally out on Friday, October 7th is when it will premiere on Showtime, on streaming and on demand for all Showtime subscribers before making its on-air television debut on October 9th. Demian Bashir is in that show, in the lead role. Presumably it's based on Let the Right One In, the Swedish film from 2008 that everyone loved, and then that remake from, was it Matt Reeves? Who did that?
Yeah,
movie?
It was. Yeah. It was Matt Reeves. That was like his, I think his first, no, it wasn't his first feature because he made The Pallbearer with David, what's his face? Schwimmer. But it was his first, like, it was kind of like Matt Reeves 2.0.
Well, was it post, he did Cloverfield.
Oh, yeah, right. It was right? Post Cloverfield. It was post Cloverfield. Yeah,
yeah, he did Cloverfield and I feel like he did Let Me In and everyone who was like, I don't care about horror remakes, but this one is good. Uh-huh. And I don't know how I feel about that. I think it was okay. I think I still very much prefer the Swedish original, which I have on Blu-ray via Magnet Releasing. Check it out if you haven't seen it. Criterion Channel on October 1st is doing an 80s horror collection. 30 movies from the 80s, including Near Dark, Toby Hooper's The Funhouse, Wolfen, Road Games, Basket Case is on there, Slumber Party Massacre, Prince of Darkness, The Vanishing, Brain Damage. If you haven't seen that, Frank Henenlotter. That's the movie that James Wan and I talked about in the interview because he hadn't seen Basket Case. Society, Tetsuo the Iron Man, Vampire's Kiss is even on there. That great Nicolas Cage movie. All right, that's all the horror news.
The Keep!
And The Keep. Michael Mann's The Keep, which yes. People love to call out as like, I don't like that one. That's not Michael Mann I don't like. They're wrong.
It's the only one I haven't seen, so I have to make sure I see it before it goes off.
You got a month, presumably. You got at least a month. All right. Now, I think we can ignore all the controversy bullshit and just talk about the movie. So, Jesse, what's your take on Don't Worry, Darling?
Don't Worry, Darling. I mean, yeah, it's I envy anyone. I don't think anyone saw it before all the gossipy bullshit was swirling around. I was going to say I envy those who do, but I don't think anyone did. Because, well, I don't know, or maybe I don't envy them. Because the movie itself, I will probably damn it with faint praise, which is pretty much what everyone's been doing. But I don't think it's as bad as a lot of people are saying, while also not thinking very much of it. It's like not a super interesting movie. But, you know, it's this movie about, as you know, maybe you've seen the trailers because they've been playing every fucking movie at AMC for the past 8 months. Florence Pugh plays a lady, young lady married to a guy played by Harry Styles in this kind of idyllic suburbs that have been plopped down in the middle of a mysterious desert area. And there's like all the people there work for, it's like a planned community, but for people who work for this mysterious corporation run by Chris Pine. And Florence Pugh's character realizes something may be amiss. Weird things are afoot in her seemingly perfect suburban lifestyle.
About 90 to 100 minutes of weird things happen to her before the movie decides to tell us what's happening. Yes. And then
could something be strange? Be going on in this seemingly early 60s inspired atmosphere?
Jesse, I'm having a feeling that the woman who keeps getting in situations that she feels physically trapped in, I feel like that is a representation of how she feels emotionally as well. Are you getting that?
No, that's ridiculous.
I'm reading into it too much.
Yeah, Oh, that's so funny. I would love to. Yeah, someone here, someone who made this movie, being like, you're reading into it too much, because it is a movie that exists only to be read into. But like, in some ways, I have to say, just as a pure genre exercise in that sort of Twilight Zone, the movie, not the actual Twilight Zone, the movie, but like a Twilight Zone episode, a movie that could be a Twilight Zone episode.
This movie would extremely benefit from being an episode of Twilight Zone or Black Mirror.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, it wouldn't have an entire middle section that doesn't need to be there at all.
Yes. But in that kind of subgenre of movie, which should probably come, I mean, actually, September isn't a weird release day for it, but like putting it at a film festival kind of put these different expectations on it. I think you put this movie out in February and it's like a perfectly passable genre programmer, you know, like it's a thriller with where something is indeed amiss. And it's, you know, like Matthew Libatic, I think his name is pronounced. I don't know. I could be saying it wrong. Shot it.
Beautiful cinematography.
Yeah, it looks nice. The acting from Florence Pugh and Chris Pine is very good. I think the scenes where they face off are notably good in perhaps a way that her other male co-star is not that great. But like, it's, you know, I was like with this movie, it is kind of pokey because it like there's nothing that really deepens about it after the first 20 or 30 minutes of something appears to be amiss in this seemingly idyllic.
That's what's so like, frustrating, 60s suburban. Dude.
Yeah.
Like, I have no problem with the setup, nor do I have any problem with how it resolves. I actually think the reveal is compelling because of the way the movie bakes it all in. Like, I think it works, and I'm annoyed that the movie treats its most interesting, unique element as like solely just this like reveal, and then it's over. Like, it's like, here's the most interesting element of the movie, and then it just ends. Like, I couldn't believe that they, instead of actually probing it like modern masculinity and modern ideas of males, how they want to dominate women and stuff, like, it only has that on the periphery, and like, that should be the whole meal. Like, that should be the whole movie. And it's so frustrating that the movie just like tiptoes around the whole thing until revealing what it is. And then the reveal, even if you find the reveal satisfying, you're bound to think the movie is not satisfying, because you're all building to this. It's just all build up. It's like, as I told my wife when we were leaving, I'm just like, there's no second act here. It's just like, it sets up act one, something's amiss here. And then from that point, you're waiting for the shoe to drop.
Yeah. Yes. And it's interesting, like, you know, I'm sure some people would go like, oh, why is this even a horror thing, something to cover on a horror podcast? And the thing about it to me is that like the elements of it that are sort of more on the edge of like horror versus satire or whatever else. I mean, I don't even know what you would even call the first hour plus of the movie. It's not really satirical, but like, the social commentary aspect, or, you know, in how the movie winds up, I think is fine. It's like, glib and sort of not that deep, but I think it works okay. But in the kind of hour leading up to it, the stuff that like really works for me is the stuff where Olivia Wilde and her writer Katie Silverstein are able to like really zero in on some like weird little twists on this kind of very familiar idyllic suburban imagery, like the Florence Pugh washing the window of her beautiful suburban house and then having the bookcase or the wall, whatever it is, slowly smush her. I mean, like, again, the subtext is like really boring and obvious and dumb, but just like the image of someone being like smushed against the glass
it's
really great. It's a good horror bit. Like,
there's some great imagery in here. I totally agree with that.
I enjoy the like stuff I'm sure people roll their eyes at a bit. The like, you know, weird images of people dance class, because there's a bunch of the wives take ballet, and like, so there's some kind of poor man's Black Swan stuff with like,
you know who shot figures. Black Swan?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, good old people Lupita. Call him Natty. Yeah, which I'm not familiar enough. I feel like it's one of those people who call Lubezki Chivo. I'm like, no, I can't. I'm not going to call a cinematographer by his nickname. Because I do not work with him. But yeah,
he's like Aronofsky's guy too. He did Mother, he's doing The Whale, and he probably did early stuff I haven't checked.
He does great. He does really nice work. And yeah, I mean, like, it's not as good as Black Swan or whatever, but like that, it's that kind of thing where it's like, okay, Black Swan isn't like a horror movie, but it has a lot of horror elements brought into psychological drama that kind of make it intense like this. This one is much more slack than something like Black Swan. But there are moments where it's kind of doing an okay cover of that. And like her looking at the, you know, reflection in the mirror and seeing stuff that other people don't see, you know, cracked glass, people smashing their heads and stuff. This is all in the trailer, so I don't think I'm giving anything away. Some of that stuff is cool. I mean, like, I was kind of diverted by that, and partially because it's beautifully shot and partially because Florence Pugh is wonderful because she's a really good actor.
She's so good. And you're right. Yeah. It's like, I mean, there's obviously a male lead sized hole in this movie that we're all... Everyone's talking around. I mean, I'm sure plenty of people are talking loudly about Harry Styles is very bad in this movie and is not a good actor. But it stands out because of how good Florence is and because of how good every scene with her and Pine together is. And then I've seen arguments to be made, and we can talk about this in a minute when we get to more spoilery stuff. But like, I've seen people defending Harry Styles' performance and like the way Florence Pugh and him interact in the movie as like, again, like baked into what the movie's doing and like what the reveal is and stuff. And I just think that's like, that's kind of cheap. I don't think that is like, oh, Harry Styles' performance is bad because his character is on a level performing or something. I'm like,
Well, I will. I'll say this about it, though. I have no love for Harry Styles as a musician. I think he's fucking boring. And so that he's like trying to do movies, I'm not interested, but particularly. And I will say, I think there's a little credence to that reading. I mean, like, the way he sort of like immaculately looks the part, but then is sort of blah when his confrontations with her, it does kind of fit the person he turns out to be playing.
It does.
It doesn't make him interesting to watch.
No, you know? He doesn't sell his scenes. And like, there was a row of girls behind us that were clearly there for like Harry watching or whatever, and they were like, maybe it was excitement and they were happy to see him, but they were like laughing at all of his big moments, like all of his big dramatic moments. And it is, I get why they were laughing. He doesn't sell them at all.
And I think
and then the reveal, I will say, when the reveal happens and you find out who he really is, so to speak, or whatever, big laugh from me. Like, I thought that was hilarious. Like, just the like physicality of how they did that and like what they made him look like. I found it so funny. He looked like, specifically like the accent, not having it or whatever, but like the American version, the American incel version of, of Harry Styles.
Yeah, it's kind of what I think my old writing group used to call the imitative fallacy, which is that like you can't really say, oh, it's supposed to be like that if like that is like includes it being boring or alienating. I mean, you can obviously you can be trying to intentionally alienate an audience, but like it's not, if something's boring or sort of dull or just kind of clumsy or whatever, you can only go so far by saying, oh, well, it's like that on purpose. It's supposed to make you feel like it's boring or dull or whatever. It's like, yeah, but then you're still watching something that's dull. So like, what, who cares, you know, even if it's effective. And he's not quite on the right side of the line, because there are times I've seen performances where I've thought, oh yeah, well, the guy's supposed to be kind of a chode or whatever, like, and so it makes sense. And this, I don't know, it just, like, there isn't enough depth to it for that to really carry off. But that's really true of the whole movie, right? Like, it's just, I think Florence Pugh and Chris Pine are more able to project some kind of human depth on this stuff that is pretty flimsy stuff. Whereas Harry Styles, not being a very experienced actor, does not really have the chops to like kind of imbue that with some unseen inner life. And you just kind of, Pugh and Pine, when they're like going back and forth, you kind of buy that there's some real animosity there. And Styles just kind of feels like he's reading his lines. I was curious, have you read anything about, like, Esther Zuckerman wrote something for the Daily Beast about, I saw her talking about this on Twitter, like the sex in the movie between the two of them, in terms of like kind of trying to square that with Wilde talking. I mean, there's a lot of, I feel like there's a lot of Wilde talking about the movie in the press, which I think a lot of criticisms about the movie have sort of unfairly picked apart dumb stuff Wilde said in interviews.
Yes, 100%. 100%. But like, I don't know what side of it Esther was on, but I did see someone else talking about this. And it's objectively hilarious to look at what Olivia Wilde was saying in the press, which is like, in my movie, only the women come, the men don't come. And like, it was like, you know, presumably an audience full of women in my mind are applauding that, right? And going like, getting their fainting couches because of how powerful of a feminist statement that is or whatever. And then you watch this movie. And if you watch this movie at this point, you're laughing because holy shit, is that a wild misinterpretation or woefully just like, that's like, it doesn't fit what the movie's doing at all. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that is what I was talking about. And yeah, she writes a bit about that.
Maybe this is the article she wrote. I was like, a great article could be written, if it's not already, by Esther, which I'm sure it is, about like the faux feminist platitudes versus like what's actually in the movie. And like, there's another controversy already brewing today on this Sunday we're recording, after everything else, which we haven't even talked about. The new one is, there's like a black character in the movie that is like posting on Instagram, well, all my scenes were cut out, but I'm just happy to be here. Like, now Olivia Wilde has to deal with that shit, which is like, you know, shit gets cut out of movies all the time. But when you're a director that is out in the public eye talking out of your ass about feminism and presumably diversity, and like, then you have your black character in a movie and you shunt her off to the side, even though she's like a key part of it and the inciting incident. Like, it just seems like there's Olivia Wilde, the public persona, the I don't know what you call the faux feminism, or like the white lady feminism, the white women feminism, the rich white lady feminism that really is like faux. It's like she's putting on an act. Like, I get why people would pick apart that particular statement after watching the movie. Yeah. And then it's easy to see why people picked apart the Shia stuff once he came out and was like, listen, lady, that's not what happened.
It's
all messy, and I feel like a misogynist just by talking about it.
Well, yeah, and I do, like, Kiki Lane thing, I understand much more. The sex thing, I feel like the logic behind making this sort of a seemingly a world where the woman's needs are catered to in certain ways kind of makes sense in a way for what you eventually see is happening, because if this is a world where she's like doting on her, she does dote on her husband, but if she's a world, this is a world where she's doting on her husband sexually.
It relies on her being happy and content, right? Is that what
you're saying?
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I could see that needing, you know, you need, I feel like if it was a,
like, day one at the fucking factory of the job, they're like, you gotta go down on your wife every day when you
go. Yeah, you just gotta
it'll keep her base level complacent. Like, I guess you
want there to be some, you want to be some level of fantasy, like, for the woman in the fantasy, even if it turns like the fact to me, it's not inconsistent that like, oh, but it looks really nice. What Esther's article says, and like, I think she get, does get a kind of a wateriness to the movie, but she also sort of says, oh, well, there's, you know, the fan, this, the fantasy is too attractive in this movie. It doesn't seem like that much of a nightmare. It's like, well, I think that's the idea, right? That it like, it's
good
not,
enough. Yeah, you it's victory.
You don't watch it for 10 minutes and go, yikes, I wouldn't want to live in that. Like, no, you're supposed to think, obviously.
Yeah, I think the opening scene does a good job of showing the like fun of the of everybody. The fun that they're all having, especially.
Yeah. I agree. And she brings up Mad Men, which is a great, you know, point. Like, it's Mad Men does a nice job of like having that glamour, but also puncturing that. And this movie just isn't on that level of like, Mad Men is like written like beautiful short fiction, and this movie is written like kind of sophomore year short story. You know,
well, so the issue is it's not, the movie isn't like, I wouldn't even call it, you can't call what happens a twist because of how the movie treats it, right? Like,
no, it's not.
It's
really
basically, this movie is a 2-hour version of a 45-minute premise, which is like something we keep coming back to, especially when you, I don't know how up to date on Black Mirror you are. There is a Black Mirror episode that is, spoiler alert from here on forward, we're going to talk about everything that happens in this movie. But there's a Black Mirror episode that is just this, that is like, playing Sims with real people. There's a movie that came out 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that we all spent weeks on Twitter making fun of, that had a very similar reveal at the end. I just can't believe the issue with this movie is, I feel like I'm keep saying the same point. It just shows you, it like plays its hand immediately, and then you have to sit there and just wait for it to show you, to like reveal the twist, like to feed you the twist, which is ridiculous. There's nothing, there's like a whole hour in the middle of this movie where I just don't know. Like, I couldn't tell you what happened in it. Like, it's just Florence Pugh waking up in different scenarios, like having these like come to Jesus moments of being like, this isn't right. And like, then you actually probe things that happen. Like, what was the plane crash? Like, does that mean anything?
Wait, I was wondering that too. I was explaining this weirdly to my kid, because after we dropped off, Marissa was going to go see it, and after the three of us had dinner, and then I was bringing my kid home, and she was asking me what the movie was that Marissa was going to see, and she asked me, as she often does, to describe like what happens in it. I was like, all right, here's what happens. Keeping my voice low to not spoil it for the other people on the subway platform. And then I was trying to, she was like, well, what? I was like, you know, this weird stuff's going on. She's like, well, what's some of the weird stuff that happens? And then like, I talk about the plane crash, and she was like, why is that weird? And I was like, I don't know, actually. Like, I don't know what actually is happening. Cause I was trying to give her the example of like, yeah, she thinks this is happening, but this is happening. And I was kind of at a loss for explaining when those weird things happen, is actually happening?
All of it falls apart if you pick at it like that.
I don't think that's a huge deal.
Yeah.
But it is a weird thing that like, there's not some like, oh, this was this.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, oh, this was like a glitch, and this was like another glitch, I guess. I don't know. Like, why would there be a plane crashing in this scenario? How would that happen? It's like, did someone unlock another level, or like, was someone doing a flight sim in the background of this and like, and fuck it up? And then they were like, you see Mario or Bowser drive by, and they're like, oh fuck, I got them all crossed. You know, I started playing Mario Kart in the middle of it, or whatever. Like, I have no idea
what
the actual thing
something
is.
About the movie, because of its structure and the way it's presented, it just, it's not, it's withholding, it's a withholding movie that like, it has no choice but to feel like a cop-out based on how they structured the movie. Like, the movie, maybe how much better would the movie be if the twist came in the second act? Like, way better. I don't know. I think
you would have to, then you have to work out how else you're going to use it, and like what else you're going to say, and how the Florence Pugh character is going to react, and like how she's going to get herself out of there. It becomes more like, or even if it's like the Truman Show, I mean, it's kind of already like the Truman Show, where Truman doesn't know that we know about the half.
Truman doesn't know. Sorry. Gotta do what
Truman doesn't know.
Yeah. We gotta write that out. We gotta do the full song. On Patreon, the Truman doesn't know, Scotty doesn't know verse.
And if you, and of course, if you saw the trailer for The Truman Show, you knew of course that like the premise of the movie is that his life is being filmed. But in the movie, you about halfway through, he doesn't know, but they cut away and show you what's going on. And then the rest of the movie is him sort of like trying to escape without knowing exactly what it is he's escaping from. And that's done so well in that movie. Not to like compare poor Olivia Wilde's movie to a Truman Show, which I think is a legitimately great movie. And only 98 minutes, by the way. So
wow,
you know, it gets it done. So like that movie does a great job of like not having him know everything, but still suspecting something's wrong and trying to work his way out regardless. I love that dynamic. And there's a little bit of that in Don't Worry, Darling, where she's like prodding at Chris Pine and trying to provoke him and trying to have like kind of a big blow up about it. Like, and you know, when she's talking to the doctor and trying to steal files to find out what's going on, but she's a little too far behind what's going on. You don't need to know 100% the whole story at that point, but if she knows a little more or suspects a little more, or the movie tells you and she doesn't know, but we do in a kind of a Hitchcockian kind of way, then I think there's a little more room for it to maneuver and for it to like have another register or sort of go into another gear. Like you said, like kind of move from have, I hate talking about acts because it's so cheesy screenwritery, but like, you're right. Like it's like a long first act and then like a quick third act, and her having more of an inkling of what's going on or the audience knowing what's going on gives you a second act. And then the third act is like the kind of, you know, the final kind of escape or whatever.
Yeah, I mean,
and the movie doesn't really do that. So it kind of goes flat, even though some of the moment to moment I was liking it, but it really doesn't build. Like, it really does not build well at all.
I was like halfway through thinking like, everyone's being so unfair to this movie. It is totally fine. But then you're right. It just kind of hits like, it just stalls for a while. Yeah. And I just couldn't believe how many times I had to sit there and like watch Florence Pugh like wake up in bed again after taking a bath or falling asleep or like whatever the fuck was happening. Anytime she would like, anytime it had those Pug between like the two worlds moments and it would like go to black and you'd hear Chris Pine's voice from his little radio show, which I think we can safely call a podcast, with Chris Pine's podcast playing.
Yeah.
I was so struck by what I saw as such clear aping of Jordan Peele's visual style, specifically in Get Out, specifically in the scenes where Catherine Keener fucking, you know, clinks her teacup and says sink into the floor or whatever.
Yeah.
It is so fucking evocative of that I'm like, I mean, you know, you can call it homage and say it, if you were to say in an interview like it was an homage to Jordan, like I feel like I would be like, of course, that's totally fine. But to me, I just inherently something feels wrong to me about like just aping that so blatantly. Maybe I'm just reading into it, but it felt so obvious to me. He basically says a variation on sink into the floor. He says sink. He says some sort of sink phrase. And that happens repeatedly. And then all the dancing stuff reminded me of Us and like the way it's shot and scored. I just think it's very deliberately doing Peele things. And like, that's fine. Peele did a whole season of Twilight Zone that was terrible. This would have been a great episode of that show. It would have been the best episode of that show. But like, I don't know. Something off about Wilde just kind of stealing those things. But I don't know if what she would say if you were to, you know, call that out to her. If she would be like, oh, absolutely, I love Jordan and I did that on purpose. Or if she would be offended that I said she was stealing something from him. But the optics of stealing something from him aren't great. But I don't know. That's an unfair thing, maybe, to criticize her for. And
I don't think it's that unfair. I think that,
dude, this movie, having that scene, everyone's in blackness, it's all shrouded in darkness, just like when he falls into the floor, and having his character over narration say sink, you can't tell me that is not post Get Out shit.
That's the thing. Get Out is a very influential movie, and it's so instructive to see how Peele has followed it up with Us and Nope, which are really like naughty, clever, you know, more divisive than Get Out, but really worthwhile and really interesting movies that I really loved, like just as much as Get Out. And then seeing, of course, and this is how it always happens, right? Like, if whoever gets ripped off, how it's been...
We've gotten a million Get Outs, to be clear. Yeah, I'm not saying this is a unique phenomenon. Yeah,
yeah, but it is probably... This is one of the more high-profile ones, because, like... actually, my wife just texted me when she was watching it while we were recording this, and she just texted me saying, like, she had a sinking feeling early on in the movie. She was like, is this an Antebellum situation? And then she was like, I wasn't that far off. It's not quite... It's, like, not quite an Antebellum
10 minutes later, is it a Serenity situation? Yeah. And you're like, ding, 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 you got it.
It's kind of halfway between the two, right? Because it's not quite as like video gamey as Serenity, and it's not like as much of a, you know, oh, it's actually the present day as Antebellum. But you know, Don't Worry, Darling is like a kind of more lavish movie than something like Alice, which was like a shitty kind of Get Out knockoff, or like, you know, any of the number of the indie horror movies that clearly want to do that kind of social commentary with wicked satire with real scares. And this is kind of the more like, it's kind of, I think it might rankle more, even though it's like better made than a lot of the knockoffs I've seen of Get Out, but it's also has that like white woman thing of like, oh, you're wanting to make like Get Out for like white people, like, yes. Or for white women. And like that rankles more, even though Antebellum is a vastly worse movie, like the kind of, you know, I don't know. I'm sure that wasn't the exact thought process.
I mean,
I know
Don't Worry, Darling, Alex Garland's Men, fucking Zach Cregger's Barbarian. You could all say these are movies about toxic men.
Yeah, and this is the least, you know, Men has, like crazy imagery, and it's kind of like a ghoulish, like unsettlingness.
And like the subtext is there, and the lack of subtext is there in the title. Like the whole thing is just like the whole exercise is, huh?
Yeah,
Men. And you get it.
And Barbarian's like a great nasty horror movie that also has this subtext going. And this one almost suffers, or it does suffer. I don't know why I say it almost. Don't Worry, Darling suffers a bit for its respectability. That whole reason that they put it at Venice and put it out in September in the first place. And it's a little more of a posh movie. And I enjoyed some of that aspect of it. I mean, it's like great to see something with such like rich production design and cinematography, and the costumes are great. And, you know, they got a couple of really good actors in this thing. I got a bunch of really good actors, but two of them had, like, you know, real
stellar performances.
Yeah. So it's like a pleasure to watch, but that also kind of feels like this kind of gussying up of like something that should be a little nastier, a little like a little more horrific, a little more. And I think the stuff that what you're talking about that works about the movie is like the horror element of it trying to fight its way out of this sort of like somewhat overly Tony treatment. And you could even say, you know, I mean, if you want to draw like a weird line, you could even say that was kind of true of Booksmart, which I think I like more. I like probably less than the rapturous response it received at the time, and more than the like really mean, this movie is worthless and horribly unfunny, and it's Hillary Clinton in movie form, horrible backlash that it received since then by like the most kind of online or leftisty of the movie people. I would, you know, I fall in between somewhere there. I think Good Books Aren't, it's like pretty funny, charming movie. It's not as good as Superbad, etc. But in a similar way that I kind of felt like that movie never really, like, unlike Superbad, never really pushed, like, you know, there's like a little bit of a lack of momentum in Booksmart, like, not to get into a whole Booksmart thing, but I think this is instructive about Don't Worry, Darling. In Booksmart, like, okay, so in Superbad, which I rewatched recently, because I've always rewatched it recently because I love it. It's not, you know, it's a little problematic, but it like makes sense for the characters. The quest is these guys want to get laid, right? Like that's the, you know, that's like what makes it such a kind of a frantic, sweaty, like we're trying to get laid. And in Booksmart, they're
in a bottle of spermicide. Oh,
it's such a fucking funny movie. And like part of the tension is that Michael Cera's character feels uncomfortable with that kind of hooking up, but also really likes this girl. Jonah Hill's character is super insecure, but also is really kind of crass and gross and like more willing to like get a girl drunk or whatever. It's the tension is in the movie, and it's really good. In Booksmart, I love the idea of these two nerdy girls who are like, well, fuck, we never partied, and like, but that didn't stop other people from doing what we want to do. So what were we doing all that, like, being kind of nerdy and uptight for? Let's go out and have fun. But that's a very nebulous goal, you know, because they don't have a I want to fuck somebody goal. Like, or so like, it's a little bit abstract. Like, nothing, there's nothing really at stake except for like one of them is like, I want to have a really awesome night. And the other one's like, okay, I guess I don't really want to. But that, you know, having an awesome night is not like a goal. You know, it's like you could have anything happen and say, oh, we did it. You know, like it just is so, it just is a little too programmatic to like really feel like in Superbad, you have like, you feel the kind of awkward heat of those crushes. They have crushes on those girls. That's what they want. That's why they're trying to get to that party. In Booksmart, it's like, well, they want to go to a party with some people, you know? So there's like, it's a little slack. Don't Worry, Darling. Similarly, it's like it wants to be this kind of, it wants to go pretty hard against toxic masculinity. And
but by way of like, why, if you're going to go after toxic masculinity in the year 2022, why do you have to go back to like the Stepford Wifey 1950s? What if the 1950s had dark underlying misogyny? Like,
right, right,
that is
exactly
something we've seen in movies already. And what the reveal is something we haven't. And they treat it like they don't, they're afraid to talk about it.
Right. And it's, and I can see why, like, you know, it sort of ties in with the, I think we can say,
you know what? The movie's afraid to talk about it. You know who's not fucking afraid to talk about it? Olivia Wilde, who's been talking in the press for months about how the villain in this movie is a Jordan Peterson type. So I had that in the back of my brain. So when it actually happened, I was like, oh, I get it now. I see what, I see exactly what she meant.
I didn't realize how literal she was being when she meant, when she talked about it.
She was being so fucking literal. And like, also, you did make that the villain of your movie. Yes, I agree that that's what you're, what you did, but you're afraid to highlight him in that way. Like you show they like, it's so amazing to me how I am so on board for that reveal, even though I'm sure tons of people will roll their eyes at it. But like I, because I'm extremely online, anytime a movie does something extremely online, like when Scream talked about toxic fandom and Reddit and The Last Jedi, like that is bait for me. And I love it. So this movie similarly, like could have done that.
Yeah, no, I like the Jordan. I think the Jordan Peterson thing is actually pretty funny, but the movie doesn't really
up yours have the woke moralists.
And that so what happens, it turns out that Chris Pine is a Jordan Peterson type who has been recruiting men to like kidnap women and plug them into a kind of
matrix. I turned to my wife and I'm like, babe, it's the they're doing the Matrix. Like, there's a part in this movie where I delightfully got to do that, which any movie that does that is going to get an extra star in my book. And that's why I recommend Moonfall. Check out Moonfall on HBO Max right now. If you want a surprise, they're doing a Matrix.
It's a Matrix.
It's a Matrix. It's a Matrix third act reveal.
But yeah, like they, so that's, you know, that's Harry Styles is not a debonair, madman-esque young professional, but in fact, creepy loser who broke
creepy loser with horrible facial hair and acne. And when they cut to him and they said, there's like a part where they're like, reveal that like, his British accent's fake, he's an American. And like when they cut him just like looking like the most incel American you could ever think of, huge laugh from, I mean, from the Harry people, but also from me. I thought that was an earned genuine laugh. Good.
That stuff is kind of is funny, and Pine is really
funny, like, but it also doesn't feel of a piece with the movie at all. But
no, it doesn't. It like the rest of the movie isn't like witty or nasty enough so that when that turn happens, it's not like Allison Williams with The Milk and Get Out, where you're like, it's like horrifying, but also it kind of goes back around to being like, oh Jesus, this is really funny in addition to being like absolutely terrifying. And the movie isn't scary enough to get you that kind of like big catharsis of that. So it's like, it is a laugh, but it's not like releasing you from any real tension because you've been kind of,
because you're right, this movie needs to be 100 times nastier or 100 times goofier. And instead, it's just right in the middle.
It's too respectable.
You're right. You really nailed it when you said the tell of this movie, like getting like ahead of its skis, so to speak, was like trying to be a festival movie and like appeal to that audience, because this movie is 100% trying to get the festival people to herald it so it'll get Oscar nominations one day, which is never going to happen. But the movie itself should be treated like a trashy paperback, or like a fucked up sci-fi horror movie, and they're just afraid as fuck to commit to that bit for some reason.
Yeah, and I appreciate what Wilde is trying to do here. I mean, this is like an interesting follow-up to Booksmart.
You know what? It almost feels subversive for a mainstream movie in a way, but it kind of tiptoes away from it.
I'm kind of weirdly glad it's doing well. I don't know. I just like feel like, yeah, this is a movie for grown-ups at least, even though it's kind
of one of those like mid-budget movies for grown-ups that they talk about not making anymore.
Yeah. So, like, I'm kind of happy that it's doing, and I really didn't have a lot of animosity towards it. but I was just kind of like,
why the, now that I think about it and talk, sorry, you, whatever you're going to say, please finish.
No, but like, yeah, go ahead.
The '50s, the whole '50s thing of it all. Like, I guess is the, I mean, the idea is what? An incel guy's idyllic paradise would be 1950s America. Like,
yeah, there, and I think that very, I guess, you know, we were about to talk about that in a couple of minutes ago. I think I sidetracked us. Yeah, that does that, even though you're very correct that this is a overly parodied, overly exposed, like the dark heart of the American suburbs. And but it is like what guys like Jordan Peterson or other weirdo, you know, online MRA types are think they're nostalgic for. It's like, oh, and you know, when men were allowed to be men,
when men were men and women were in the kitchen and they made me my dinner that I come home to every day and I eat her out obligatorily. I don't want to, but I have to.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. This is trying to get at that. So I get why they're using it, but I think, and then Esther Zuckerman pointed this out in her piece, the movie actually takes bits and pieces from like 40s, 50s, and 60s in terms of its of the style that you were looking at. And I think it probably would have behooved them to mix and match even more and not have it. So it really does feel like mid-century. Like you could even, even though I think there is stuff, she's right. There is stuff from the 40s and
it's
from the
60s. It's very specific.
You could
like
say
that
it's 55. You could say it's 1955 and it would track. And I think you're right that's so familiar that it might be neater if it was something that was able to pull in stuff from other eras and start to get really kind of trippy about what it is rather than 1955, but a little weird. You know, there's nothing that strange, because especially if you don't know the era that well, you know, a younger person's not going to watch this and go, oh, I don't know, actually that was more 1947 than 1955. Like, you know, you're just kind of say, oh yeah, this is old timey. And the movie doesn't really, again, it's just another thing that the movie doesn't like push that hard on, which is disappointing.
Yeah, my friend Chris put it well. He said, like, I'm sure someone's calculated a golden ratio of amount of setup to quality of twist, and this movie does absolutely not qualify. Like, it is, there's a part in the middle where I didn't have my notes, so instead of notes, I just like whispered things to my wife, and like the thing I whispered is, I'm like, I just said there's no middle. Like, we keep watching Florence. I think it was like the third time when Florence had like woken up and not known what had just happened. Yeah. And I'm like, that is, it's like, it's all the movie's got type of joke, where it's like, all this movie has is Florence Pugh like walking around looking quizzically at shit for 90 minutes before pulling out the rug from under you and explaining what's happening. And like, but the way I'm talking about it, I feel like you'd think I was rating it very low, but like, I'm like 2.5 on it. I'm just like,
yeah, same.
You're so right that like, it's halfway there, and I think the setup is fun. I just wish there were less setup, more of the reveal. But
yeah, you get a little antsy kind of waiting like in between these sort of like fairly similar freak out set pieces. Because there's not like no progress is made for her.
What is it about this movie that is like keeping it from being as wild? Like, wild things happen in this movie, but the movie does not, like, it's not a wild movie. Like,
I can't help now thinking of it as wild with a D. Wild things happen in this movie, including Olivia Wilde being in it and directing it, and yet it is not wild. No, I mean, I'm always tempted to be like, Brian De Palma would have known what to do with this, but it's like yet another one of these thrillers where you're like, Brian De Palma would really know how to knock this shit out of the park.
Some
but he's not
there would
the
be
only
a split
guy.
Screen sequence we would really love if Brian De Palma made this.
I mean, you could have the split screen in one in reality and one in the fantasy virtual.
You just improved
world.
This movie tenfold.
De Palma. I mean, like, but you know, that's kind of facile because De Palma's not the only director of thrillers in Hollywood. And I think Olivia Wilde is a good director. I think it was smart of her to pivot to directing, and like she shows like an interest in a couple, you know, this is it's very different from Booksmart. Although what I wrote in my review is that Beanie Feldstein, it's the kind of movie that Beanie Feldstein's character from Booksmart would write. It's like, it's like, or would make, because it's like very polished and she knows what she's doing and it's, you know, technically fine, but is like, you know, that's just kind of boring feminist talking points in the script. Like, it feels like what someone who's not that inspired but is a good student would make. So, you know, I don't know. Like, I think I do think it's just missing that, like, you know, that kind of frenzy, that kind of like, it's a little calculated. So it feels a little like, you know, for my next movie, I will make a thriller. You know, it's not like something that feels torn out of her soul. Not that, again, not to cast aspersions on it. I really kind of feel bad for Olivia Wilde because it feels like one of those things where anything she says just gets thrown back at her.
Yeah, she's damned if she does, damned if she doesn't at this point. Yeah.
And I'm sure she's like kind of annoying and unpleasant and like fake and in person as like most actors and directors probably are. But she just has the misfortune of, of not being
the lack of backstory maybe for like the inciting incident is maybe also what takes away from it. Cause like, it's just supposed to be like men bad, do bad thing. And it's like, it doesn't really give you like who this guy was. You get such a shitty condensed version of like who this guy actually is, not the fake version that there's something, again, I'm so fascinated by that backstory and like the idea of behind the like, whose time is it? Our time. And like all that stuff that is just like merely hinted at. But this movie rather play dress up and like do 1950s stuff. And just like,
Sorry.
Go ahead. No,
I was going to say.
No, I refuse.
Not to continue to backstage screenwrite, but like, I'm just thinking of this because we just watched Barbarian recently. Like, would it make, you know, we're talking about like, oh, when to reveal this stuff. Wouldn't it be kind of cool and compelling to, and I don't, well, I'll say this and then add my caveat. Wouldn't it be kind of cool and compelling to, in the middle of the movie, go to Harry Styles' character in the real world, quote unquote, and follow his character, and then you're going, what the fuck? Like, wait a minute.
Yeah, dude, that would be so jarring and fucked up to see, like, his little incel life. Exactly. Like, now I want every movie to pull a Barbarian. Like, a horrific POV montage of a stalking sequence.
And that maybe sounds like I'm saying, you know, oh, could this just be about the man? Because the movie does this a little bit because it does like go to Florence Pugh and you're like, oh, interesting. Like this is her, but it's not the same person we knew. But it like you said, it happens so late in the movie that it doesn't really build, like it doesn't really build up anything. And you're kind of, oh, okay, I'm starting to see where the pieces fall together.
It wants you to know so you can have an answer and to explain it to you. But it doesn't work as like pathos or anything because of how it's treated. It's just like, yeah, here you go. Here's your explanation. Where I'm like, oh, this is interesting. Tell me more about these people. Why is she married to this fucking guy? Like, it just doesn't, it doesn't hold up to scrutiny when you're like, yeah, okay, well, I don't buy that relationship at all. Like, why would she be with this fucking total incel? Like, it doesn't, and she's a doctor? Why is she, like it just, it left me with more questions. And I think if it were handled better or written better or I don't know what, that shouldn't be what I come away thinking. I shouldn't be thinking about all the issues with that. Like, it should have been this big moment. But anyway, this just goes to say we're talking in circles around the same things, I feel like. But for all the press quotes from Olivia Wilde about what it's about and toxic masculinity, it is really not at all about that. It rather just be like a Stepford Wifey, wasn't it better back then type of satire.
It's
just surface level shit instead of this could have been really compelling and it could have been an actual, if they actually explored that toxic masculinity stuff beyond just passing mention to it, this would have been a surprisingly compelling movie. But as is, it just like is a middling, like, I'm totally fine with it. I think it's fun enough. I think it's like a good looking movie. It like looks like an actual movie. You go see it in a theater. It doesn't look like you're watching a movie that was made to be watched at home. It does look like you're made to be watching it in the theater, and that's nice. But it's definitely missing a great chunk of what would make it work. Something's off. It's like, it's not, I don't know, man. There's like a different way you compose this movie or rearrange it, and it could be more compelling. But I don't know what the whole first, very long first act, middling, or just completely like rushed through a brochure of a third act instead of like the meat of it. It's a confusing movie, but like it's about as good as a movie with no middle can be. I didn't have a terrible time with it.
Yeah.
People calling it, like, anyone piling on is just being mean because it's like in vogue to be mean about this movie.
Yeah, it's not like worth getting really worked up over. I think it just is like, it's kind of an interesting failure because it's not like a really, maybe it's not the true like interesting failure where it's like this spectacular disaster. It's just sort of like, oh yeah, this doesn't quite work, which happens all the time. But this one has had so much attention that, of course, people are more interested in the mechanics of it not working. But yeah, I think a lot of them in the weird way aren't really talking that much about the mechanics of it not working. I just want to say, isn't Harry Styles terrible, or isn't Olivia Wilde a jerk, or whatever. I don't know. It's weirdly, even the hype over, even the kind of salaciousness of it is weirdly overhyped. At the same time, that is, I think what I wrote about in my room for Inside Hook about the movie is that I think one of the reasons people are lashing out to the gossip stuff is that the movie kind of puts it all out there and says, like, you know, here's the solution to the movie, and it's pretty familiar. And the gossip stuff is so unknowable because you don't really know. Maybe you'll find out someday, like, you know, kind of the specifics of the shouting match she supposedly had, the Florence Pugh supposedly had with Olivia Wilde or whatever else, or how her relationship with Harry Styles affected the production, or how other people felt, whatever. That's all kind of unknowable, which is something the movie could use, something a greater sense of, like, mystery or kind of, you know, perversity or whatever. And the movie just doesn't have enough of that. So yeah, it's natural to go over to the gossipy stuff and start talking about that instead. It's kind of more glamorous than what the movie actually gives you.
Why are the guys working on some shadowy government project either? Like, why is there this fake little mystery inside the program? Is it just like they're keeping the program alive? Is that like...
Yeah, well, they need to... They must... Yeah, I wonder if... that's something else that they don't really... Yeah, like, that's to give them a reason to leave, like, because they presumably have to go out and make money to like, in the real world or whatever.
To give them reason to like exist in reality.
Out. It certainly tracks.
So like, it doesn't think about it from the perspective of the people in the movie. Like, it doesn't make sense for it to be this shadowy government secret thing. It would just I'm going to the office, honey. I'm going to the store I work. To the hardware store. Like, it just, like, doesn't work on that level, I don't think.
It's sort of, it's probably to justify the, like, well, don't think too much about it, or, like, we're all in this together, and trying to create kind of a feeling of community or whatever. That's kind of more, I'm sure that's kind of Pine's invention, that it needs to be, like, this kind of culty thing. But you're right, as a pure practical, keep these women docile and in their place, it would just make sense for them not to pretend to all work. I would simply not pretend to be working on some kind of nefarious, like, world-changing plot that seems really...
Yeah, and, like, what are all the, like, what is the stupid shit they keep saying that they're working on? Something about, like, reactions? I don't even remember.
Yeah,
they keep alluding to shit that, like, you think would be, like, could be, like, nuclear shit, or, like, I don't know. Once you actually finish the movie and see what it's about... And then you go back and think about all those other, like, MacGuffin mystery elements. You're just like, oh, this is shallow bullshit. This is not, none of this actually meant anything or was supposed to mean anything. It's all just misdirection or whatever. I don't know. Not very good. Not very good. The more I talk about it, the less I'm like, ugh. I wish it were better. I just wish it were better. Because it's like almost there for a while and then it just lies there. But it looks nice.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a bad time at the movies, but it's not as galvanizing as you would hope it would be for all you've read about it.
And if you are someone who doesn't live online and you don't know what controversies we're talking about, quick summary is that I think this all stemmed from Florence Pugh not doing press for the movie. And everyone's like, why the fuck is Florence Pugh not doing press for the movie? And then reporters dug in and figured out that there was animosity between them on the set. The rumors include stuff like, Olivia Wilde was dating Harry Styles, and she would disappear while directing and disappear for hours at a time with him. And
some of it was like Florence was directing the movie herself. She was working with the actors more than Olivia.
Yes.
I kind of don't buy that, but you know,
I don't know how much truth there is to that. There's like a faction of crew members who put out a statement saying any of that stuff is bullshit, but you can't, like, if one person had that experience and saw it, it's real. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, I don't know. Who knows what happened, but there was definitely like, it definitely seemed, based on Florence Pugh's public, not even posturing, just like what she's doing and what she's not doing, it would seem like she does not like Olivia Wilde or does not want to be promoting this movie in any way.
Yeah.
She's not doing the usual circuit. And that type of thing has to get cleared with like the head of the studio. It was said that the head of the studio was involved in negotiating, keeping Florence on the movie, but not doing the press for it. So like, there's definitely truth in some of the rumors. It seems like it was a annoying production for some, definitely for Florence. There's also that stuff with Shia LaBeouf, which like Shia LaBeouf was supposed to star in it, but got like left the movie for his own reasons, because he didn't think it was going to work out. But Olivia Wilde and the press made it seem like she fired him to protect Florence, when it seems like, based on actual text and stuff we've seen, that it wasn't like that at all. And Olivia Wilde is playing both sides of the fence on that. So yeah, basically,
I kind of feel like LaBeouf probably is too, though. I feel like he's probably.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny when like everyone's like, oh, well, Shia LaBeouf is the one we believe here, because like, yeah, he's like, yeah, a public menace also. Yeah, people don't like him for several reasons, but we're choosing to believe him here because he had text messages or whatever. There's proof.
And I feel like, some of it was like, oh, he, not to get super into this, but he's like, oh, you know, she, that's not what she said to me. It's like, yeah, she was like the director trying to glad hand a famous person. Like,
yeah, of course.
Sure.
She's going to,
She's not going to be like, there's not going to be a text that's like, you're fired, motherfucker. You know,
You are a bad guy and I don't like you and you're fired for these transgressions. Like, that's not what it was ever going to be. So she just keeps, she can't say anything in the press without it becoming a story at this point. And it's all just nonsense. Like, no,
it's
one knows anything.
This movie made more. Let me see if this is. Let me double check my no, it's not quite true. I was gonna say this movie made more in its first weekend than Booksmart made in its entire run. But I think it's close. It is close. Booksmart made how much domestic? Let's see. Looks like it made 28. Yeah, it made 20. Yeah, it's actually more than I thought. 23 domestic. 25 domestic. And this one made 23 domestic, and this one has already made close to 20. So this week it'll pass the complete gross of Booksmart. So that's where getting a critically acclaimed movie gets you. where nobody seemed to have a problem on the set of that movie, but it did not make any money.
Yeah, this I'm not reading into it anyway of that. I think this movie made what it was always going to make. And clearly it was top loaded with like a lot of that money from the $19 million for this weekend. It should have made it to 20 and it didn't, because it seems very front loaded. All the early preview screenings really helped it make that much. It's not going to, it's going to leg out. I don't know. It's going to make like 40 maybe.
Yeah.
Does that seem right?
Maybe more. I think maybe even it could end up making more, because just like this audience, is there a lot of stuff for this audience? Well, I guess Amsterdam could be for this audience. It's going to be one of those things where I don't know, the word of mouth is like, not, I don't think is that great, but at the same time, like,
what else is there to see, man?
Yeah, what are you going to see, huh? And some of that is the front loading, I think, is less bad word of mouth and more the Harry Styles fans going out right away. It should do fine for the studio. I bet it'll do okay internationally, too, because Styles is an international star. It's interesting to see where Wilde will be in her career after this, because obviously there is lots of bad press about her set. At the same time, her movie's making a lot more money than her previous movie. So it's the weird, but it's also because probably somewhat because of the stars and because of the Harry Styles factor. It's all just a very strange, it's a strange thing.
Yeah. Just a disappointing kind of unimaginative experience that I wish pushed into new territory rather than just kind of said things we already know. And then once it gets to like the modern twist on it, it just kind of goes, huh? How about that? And then, and then it's over. We talked about this for longer than I thought we would. I hope we didn't talk circles around each other. What else do I want to mention? Smile is next week. I've heard good things about it at Fantastic Fest, which I have been covering remotely all weekend. And Fantastic Fest, more like few and far between our Fantastic Fest. Jesus Christ.
Oh.
I am sift. I mean, this is nothing to, this is not a burn on the festival. This is a burn on all festivals. You're going to a movie festival, unless it's like a very well curated one, like the New York Film Festival. And even then, maybe, but definitely a genre festival. You're going to be sifting through a lot of 2.5-star max. A lot of movies that max out at 2.5 stars and really struggle to keep my interest. So, I've had a long weekend, a long week with COVID, watching all the Fantastic Fest movies.
Fantastic COVID week. Wow.
Fantastic Fest at COVID. It's now New York Film Festival starting as of the day this podcast comes out. So Jesse and I will be watching 30 to 40 movies there over the course of 3 weeks.
That's probably, I think I'm going to cap myself lower than that. But yeah, it's going to be a lot
of movies. I'm going to try to do a lot. And then we also have Smile to do. And then Halloween Ends. We got a lot of horror. And of course, as I mentioned previously, we will be doing Hellraiser. Not quite ahead of New Hellraiser, but in conjunction with New Hellraiser.
Is New Hellraiser come out the 7th?
The New Hellraiser, I think comes out the 7th. We're supposed to get screeners this Friday. So yes.
Oh, wow.
I believe it comes out the 7th. So yeah, we have plenty of stuff to talk about. Happy. It's almost October. It's spooky season, everybody. But oh, you know, at the New Flesh, it's spooky season all year round because we're living the hashtag horror lifestyle. Thank you so much, Jesse, for talking about Don't Worry, Darling. If you were wondering, where's this week's Roger and me? It was COVID delayed until I saw Don't Worry, Darling. And we'll be doing that tomorrow, I hope. So that should be out soon. And if not, we'll double it on next Friday and do a double length episode. What's your first New York Film Festival scheduled movie? What are you doing? Are you doing anything tomorrow?
I'm not doing anything tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm just going to see Smile. Me too. I'm going to do something on Tuesday.
Showing Up.
Showing Up is my first one. Yeah, going to start it off with a nice Kelly Reichardt. I'm going to see White Noise on my fucking birthday. I'm hurrying to probably not finish the novel before then, but
is
we'll
that
see
the
if
press
I can
screening
get
on Friday morning?
Yeah, the Friday morning.
I can't make the press screening, but they gave me a opening night ticket, so I'll go at 9:30 p.m.
Ooh,
and I
nice.
Last time I did that, I didn't realize that opening night of the festival, people dress in suits and shit, and I showed up in sweatpants and a sweater and watched the fucking Macbeth movie with everyone all dressed up for the nines. So that'll be me with the cast of White Noise. I'll wear my best horror hoodie and I'll try to walk the red carpet for a second so I get in a Getty image or something. So be on the lookout for that. The Getty image of me at the premiere of White Noise.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
And check out the Patreon for all that stuff. I can't believe we forgot to mention, Jesse, that this movie borrows a line from the iconic Frankie Muniz horror film Stay Alive, where someone basically says in this movie, if you die in the game, you die in real life.
The William Brent Bell film from 2006.
Yes, the early William Brent Bell.
It's one of the work. Early Bells, yes.
It's like when you talk about Kevin Hart and you're really a big fan, you can go, well, I saw him years before he hit it big with Soul Plane. He was in Soul Plane years before he hit it.
When I watched Stay Alive at the Center Cinema 5 in Queens, New York, in Sunnyside, New York, which had...
Hold for applause.
Yeah. You guys, anyone here from Flushing? Anyone here from not Flushing? Anyone here from Sunnyside?
Yeah, we're doing our live episode again. There are suddenly huge masses of people
massive
in Astoria,
people.
Queens. Yes.
When I first moved to the city, they had matinees on and Tuesdays nights for $4.50 for first round movies. So when I saw Stay Alive there, I never thought that like 15 years later I would be enjoying multiple movies by the same director, but here we are. What a miracle.
Well, Jesse, we've got to end this podcast because if we die on the podcast, we die in real life.
In real life. Yes.
And I can't have that.
True of most podcasts, I think.
If you die on Joe Rogan, you don't die.
Yeah.
You stay alive forever. All right. Bye.
Forgive me if I don't stay around to watch. I just can't cope with the freaky stuff.